I say 7. I'm learning how to dance because I have no one to dance with. So, dressed to the teeth, I cup my hand against the supple small of no one's back, stride off to any music, effervescent, expert, elegant as velvet on my feet. I'm learning how to dream because I have no one to sleep with, so undressed to the teeth, I lie down with a whisper next to no one, trace my fingers along each cheek, touch behind each knee, then I let my quick, wet lips do all my talking. I'm learning how to write because I have no one to read to, so some nights you should see me. Nothing but skin and bones in underwear and socks, reciting my finest lines to the bare walls until they whisper and applaud. And when I have put enough love in my words to last us till morning, there is a dance goes on in that room that they do not teach in any class. I wrote this poem about 40 years ago, the last time I found myself suddenly single. It's called Social Dancing, the name of a course I was taking right then. It seems, on first take, like a bit of fluff, a nothing much poem. I sent it out a few times to note takers, I didn't see why. I'm sure some editors thought, oh, give me a break, nobody does this. Well, I did. I liked the poem then, and I still do. Here's why. The first two sections describe exactly what I started to think about today. The experience of falling in love with nothing. No one. The history of poetry is rife with poems about falling in love with something. Someone. But human beings also fall in love with nothing. No one. Almost have to in order to do the other things. If I could have found a poem that said that, I probably wouldn't have had to write this one. In any case, that's what I started thinking about this morning, how I'm falling in love with nothing, no one. And then there's the last section. Well, that tells you everything you need to know about why I write. It's not the thing that ends up on the page. It's what I do beforehand, in underwear and socks, and what comes after, that dance that goes on in that room. Wow, that sweet, unteachable dance. In any case, much to my surprise, I spent most of my walk today, this perfect late autumn morning, the leaves mostly still up and airbrushed in shades of red, yellow, orange, thinking about love. Not the standard versions that consume so much of our time and attention, romantic, love for another, fraternal, love for kin and kind, or spiritual, love for the transcendent, the ones we inherit from the cultural air and tend, or pretend, to practice in rote ways. I mean, true love. It's been kind of simmering on my back burner lately because it came up in a conversation I had with a member of our seminar group right before class started a few weeks ago. I think it was because we were about to discuss Plato's Phaedrus, in the middle of which is Socrates' transcendent speech on love, the right kind of love, that madness from the gods that possesses us from the outside in. True love. We talked briefly about Paul's letter to the Corinthians with the famous love is patient, love is kind speech, his attempt to tamp down the stupid bickering in the early church. My daughter made a white-on-black painting of that passage when she was in college. The long series of qualities Paul assigns to love circling gradually outward on the canvas, getting smaller and smaller until they fill it right up to the edges. When I need to get myself centered, I look at that painting. Pick any two of those qualities he mentions, and you have a place to start getting yourself right when you're not. I say look at rather than read because it has the kind of physical impact a painting can have, so difficult to match in a text, especially if it's all cramped up inside a thick little Bible, taking you half an hour to find it. I know Bridget was dealing with some hard things then. Right in the middle of the canvas, the line, Love endures all things, is in big, broad strokes. That always moves me. Endures, such a good word. All things, even better. There's another painting of hers I have in the bathroom, where I can see it when I take a bath, one of my favorite modes of relaxation. It has a purple background with thick, clunky brown tree trunks jutting awkwardly all the way up, so whatever leaves they have would be outside the perimeter of the canvas, hogging the sun. Right in the middle is a much smaller tree, so fragile looking, spangled with the most beautiful emerald green leaves, individualized, but cascading down like liquid. From the sky above, dozens of gold droplets are drizzling down and over it, the only real light in the scene. It is so inspiring to me. If I saw it in a museum, I would sit there and stare at it for a long time. I would wish it were mine. She had the habit back then of titling her paintings with black paint at the bottom of the scene, large text, quick and messy, like it's part of the painting rather than an index to what the painting depicts. This one is called A Small Tree in a Wooded Forest. Sounds pretty tame, until you start to think about some of the ways that small and wooded play out in real life. I didn't talk about these paintings in that conversation we were having before class. I just thought of them today while I was walking. We did, though, briefly talk about the opening of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. I'm always taken aback by that sequence, how radical it is, the Word, how it's out there, with God, is God, before anything else at all. Even Derrida doesn't go that far. But it is really nothing, mumbo jumbo, until it is embodied, made flesh in the world. I may not be on particularly good terms with God these days, but I believe that if you don't embody your Word, make it fully flesh in the world, fulfill through what you do the promise of what you say, well, to me, what you say is empty. Mumbo jumbo. Words need to mean something outside of words. That's another kind of love I'm thinking about today, the kind I had for Carol and the kind we have always had for Bridget and Joe. If you had asked me in July, say just 3 months ago, whether I would love again, in a deep emotional sense, that is, the kind that both exhilarates and hurts, often both at the same time, I would have said, no, never, period. My heart was, I would tell you, broken for good, to borrow a phrase from a poem I wrote about Roy Orbison a long time ago. It was off and was not going to come back on again, period. It was closed and was not going to open up again, period. This was not a matter of choice on my part, a decision I made in grief, some grand promissory gesture to my lost lover, or out of anger, a passive-aggressive holding back. It was just what reality had done to me. Death comes in many stages and ways. This was mine, and it was final. My heart was down, done, dead. I wasn't even that bothered by it. All of the things I want to do in the world with the rest of my life, the ones that require love at least, may be more easily done when the emotional switch is on, to be sure, the circuit open, a good charge running through. But they can be accomplished just as well, and sometimes more surely, purely on principle. This is right. This is good. This is what I will do, no matter what. End of story. The love I needed to do what I wanted with the rest of my life was, in July, founded on that and that only. Clean, efficient, principled. Carol is the one who got me thinking about this very thing a number of years ago as she explained to Bridget that the love we both showered on her and Joe, that they felt and appreciated so deeply, so unremittingly, though it may often have a rich emotional aspect to it, was not dependent on emotion, which is by definition unreliable, up and down, here and gone. The love we operated on was principled. It did not change with the diurnal vagaries of life. Hard or easy, light or dark, cold or hot, it was there. We were there, in place, on time, always would be. Steady, utterly dependable. It was a promise we made and kept, would always keep, no matter what. Carol and I had that kind of love together, better or worse, richer or poorer, sickness and health, until death do us part. We said those words once, then we lived them every day. I never had that kind of love from a woman before, and I'm pretty sure I never will again. Amazingly, Carol was the smartest, sweetest woman I ever met. And she was so beautiful, stunningly so. That she picked me, well, as Yeats said, it's certain that fine women eat a crazy salad with their meat. I am a crazy salad. Last summer, someone asked me whether I thought I would find love again. I said, but I believe. I have no philosophical objection to that. But it's not going to happen. I am old and weird, and I'm only going to get older and weirder. Carol liked me that way, exactly that way. So I know how it feels to be loved for who I am. I can't imagine. This who that I am right now is going to be very appealing to anyone else that way, ever. So no, I didn't expect to find love again. In any case, when I said that, my heart was off. Now my heart is on again. I am stunned. It all started up the weekend I spent in central Illinois for my son's wedding. I won't go into elaborate detail, though I could, pages of detail. Just this, the wedding. So perfect, so beautiful. These two good young people, my son and his now wife, so much in love, so devoted to one another. My daughter, who turns on the lights in every room she enters. She is that electric. The exotic theme-based rooms in the B&B she picked for us to stay at. Bridget and Joe doing so well, miraculously rising up from the wreckage of last winter to the beautiful blue skies of their ongoingly good lives. My being able to meet and greet all these new people so happily, gracefully, sociable at my upper extreme. All of it magical. That was the word I chose immediately and instinctively to describe the weekend to others after I got back. Magical. Heartwarming, I'd say now, today, literally, I mean, and then my heart was warmed back into action again. Slightly at first, like a light laughter at a slight joke. Then the gradual relaxation that often follows, a laughter that doesn't need a joke to inspire or sustain it. I didn't realize it then, but I see it in retrospect. Then warmer and warmer over the next few weeks, not so much like turning the heat up in the winter to make your space livable. More like opening the blinds and windows in midsummer, the sun heating things up in its own good way, outside in, for free, easy, day after day, lounging in its luxurious, cozy warmth. A few weeks after I got back from the wedding, I started looking around for old happy love songs from the late 60s, my coming-of-age era, some sweet, disarming songs for the next CD I would send to my brothers. I picked out an assortment of the most charming ones I remember, some in the bubblegum pop vein, and had a blast singing and recording them. I'm Into Something Good by Herman's Hermits, Crimson and Clover by Tommy James and the Shondells, Love Is All Around Me by the Troggs, I Think It's Gonna Work Out Fine by Ike and Tina Turner, songs like that, fantastic. I actually felt like I was young again, but better, because I know so much more than I did back then. I felt it happening in real time, my heart starting to warm back up. But it was not for anyone in particular, anyone at all. Wow, I thought I was falling in love again with no one. A normal person might have put a halt on it. I am not a normal person. I did not put a halt on it. Why should I? I liked everything about it. Just let it go, lay back in it, that midsummer sun, happy to be able to feel warm again. I thought today about Don Quixote, how he knows he's just a jackass on a jackass carrying a stick. But he does it anyway because he feels like it. It's better than reality. Way better. I've never read advice columns in the newspaper. I don't like advice to the degree that even if I know the specific piece of it coming my way is good, I'll ignore it, even do the opposite on principle. After Carol passed, I found myself glancing at them, though, reading a letter here and there, sometimes several. I was struck, first of all, by the problems people felt they couldn't solve for themselves. I'd read the response and think, duh. But the other thing that struck me, and I'm pretty sure now this is why I was being drawn toward them, was what people thought of as problems. Got really agitated about, felt distressed about. Maybe there was a time I had problems like that. I hope not. But I know I don't now and never will again. Those are not problems. They are life. A wife's death, a husband's, a mother's, a father's, or, worst of all, a child's. Those are problems. And no advice is going to solve them. In any case, I mention this because recently I read a letter from a mother who was concerned that her young son, he was 4 or 5, I don't remember exactly, but very young, walked around humming. She wanted to cure him of this right now so he would grow up to be the office whistler. Apparently, to her, and I assume many others because there is such a term which I never knew before, it's quite a terrible fate. I didn't bother reading the response. It is too late for me. I am the office whistler. I have been my whole life. Maybe I started down this wayward path with humming. I don't remember. But as soon as I learned to whistle, I did it all the time. It irritated people. I was chided for it many times. I assumed back then it was because I was a bad whistler, unpleasant. Now I know. These people had my best interests at heart. If only I had heeded their advice. I whistled my way through many years at many jobs. I can see now the error of my ways. I would have been much more successful if someone, that boy's mother, say, had really scared it out of me when I was 5. I talk about this here because when I started to sing, all this escalated. I'm now the office singer. Most days at work, a tune will get in my head, maybe a song I'm learning, and I sing it whenever I'm in a public space alone, especially in the stairwells, which at Pitt go up and down for many stories, huge echo chambers, making my voice sound powerful, like everyone's does in the shower, all of that tile to bounce it around off. I always stop, though, when someone else comes into view, up or down, primarily because, well, I don't know why, I just do. One day I was walking up the steps toward my office floor, alone, singing My Blue Heaven, such a lovely song. I think I carried it off pretty well. I was distracted, so I didn't see the woman who was descending from one of the floors above, about my age, someone I didn't know. I stopped singing when I saw her, but much too late. I said hello as I approached, and she said, I heard you, kind of sing-songy. I couldn't tell whether she meant, nice song, thanks, or you're one of those stupid office whistlers, except worse, you sing loud. I could still see her in my mind's eye, the way she kept walking, the look on her face. I can still hear in my mind's ear the tone of her voice. Could have been either. A few weeks later, before a meeting at work, I was sitting in my chair, flipping around on my iPad, singing softly to myself without even being aware of it. A colleague a few rows up asked, I know in a friendly way because she's a nice person, is there music on your iPad? I said, no, there is music in my head. She asked why, again, friendly, and I said, without even thinking, something I never put into words before, because it's the only way I can tolerate reality. I knew when I said it, I had fathomed the truth about my lifetime of humming, whistling, singing. It was always the only way I could tolerate reality. A way of marking clearly the boundary between out there, the reality you can't shake no matter what, and in here, the one you better take possession of early and hold on to hard. That little boy, the Hummer, if I could write the response, I'd tell his mother to cherish him, thank him, and to hope that her son grows up with music in his head. Because the out there has already defeated and fully occupied her in here. It is too late to save herself. He still has a chance. Tell him every day what a great Hummer he is. Teach him to whistle, to sing, all of it. Say how much you enjoy that too. Don't take it away from him just so he, or maybe it's you, which is way worse, can save some face in that horde of morons who might not take him seriously, ignore him, even make fun of him at work. They're not worth it. He is. His in here is still there. Help him not to trade it all in for what's out there. I am, I can assure you, a full-grown man with, especially now, a full grasp of reality, how intractable it is, what it demands, without any intention of taking no for an answer. I wake up in that reality every morning and go to sleep in it every night. That little bird in the rose garden in Eliot's Burnt Norton saying, go, 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 because humankind cannot bear very much reality. Well, he's being kind. Yes, go if you still can. But what if you can't go? And quite often you can't. Then you'd better learn fast how to bear reality, even if there's very much of it. At least if you want to stay human and kind, two words that Eliot oddly separates. Anytime you fall in love, like Carol and I did, you're putting some part of the charge on a credit card. You live as long and as happily with that debt as you possibly can. One day, one or the other of you will have to pay what's left on the bill. It came due last February. At some point, pretty much every day, I sit down, write the check, and send it off. That kind of love. And by the way, the next time you hear me singing in the stairwell, don't think, wow, what a clown. Didn't he get the memo about office whistling? Think, wow, whatever he's got going on in there, I wish I could get me some of that.